Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 114, Making Sense of Complexity. A key goal of science is to collect a whole bunch of observations and try and make sense of them. We do learn a lot this way, although answering some questions then just brings up more questions. For example, Dear Cheap Astronomy, why does the fact that further away galaxies move faster indicate that the universe is expanding? It is all a lot to take in. Not only are farther away objects moving faster, but also the universe is expanding faster now than it was in the past, and there's all this stuff about standard candles and redshift, and much room for confusion. So, let's start with Edwin Hubble. He was into Cepheid variables, which are a type of standard candle. Any variable star varies in brightness, generally appearing to pulsate. What became clear with Cepheid variables was a direct relationship between their pulse rate and their intrinsic brightness. That is, how bright they really are up close. And it's all thanks to Henrietta Swan Leavitt for that. What it means is that you can observe a Cepheid variable, measure its pulse rate, and hence know how bright it would be up close. There are a lot of them, just within our own galaxy, so it's easy to build up a database about them. Then, any time you observe a new Cepheid variable, you just determine its pulse rate, and you'll immediately know what its intrinsic brightness is, and a dim one must be further away than a bright one is. And so, by knowing the various brightnesses of Cepheid variables of known distances, you can calculate the distance of the new one you've just observed. Hubble, who had access to the world's most powerful telescope at the time, the Hooker Telescope at Mount Wilson, was able to measure the pulse rate of Cepheid variables in what was then called the Andromeda Nebula to determine it was so far away it must be way outside the Milky Way and hence must be a galaxy in its own right. Hubble also made similar observations of other nebula/galaxies, confirming that the universe was way bigger than anyone had been presuming and was chock-a-block full of galaxies. Hubble also measured the redshift of these various different galaxies, building on Vesto Slipher's work, who had established the relationship between different objects' redshifts and their recessional velocity, that is, how fast they are moving away from us. Hubble demonstrated a correlation between the distance of different galaxies and their redshift, hence establishing the principle that farther away galaxies are moving away from us faster than close galaxies are. Hubble's correlation was a bit wonky, but was later shored up by subsequent observations with better telescopes. It turned out that the motion of very distant galaxies is primarily due to universal expansion, while the motion of closer galaxies can be more variable due to their own intrinsic motion in directions other than just straight outwards. But anyway, the objective of this podcast is to explain why farther away stuff moving away faster than closer stuff moves away is actually clinching proof that the universe must be expanding. So, imagine a set of dots set 1 meter apart on a straight line in a universe that expands at 1 meter a minute. If you're on one dot, the next dot along will expand away from you at 1 meter a minute. But the next dot after that dot will expand away from you that first meter plus another meter, and the next dot after that will expand away 3 meters all in that same 1 minute. And so, QED, if you see farther away things moving away faster than closer things are moving away, it really is clinching proof that the universe is expanding. The next step to conclude that the universe's expansion rate is actually increasing arose from observations of Type 1a supernovae in very, very distant galaxies, where type 1a supernovae always explode with the same brightness and are therefore also standard candles. It was found that supernovae in galaxies with very high redshifts were dimmer than they should have been if universal expansion had been happening at a constant rate all along. So, although there is a close correlation between distance, measured by the brightness of your standard candles, and recessional velocity, measured by redshift, we find that very, very distant objects are actually farther away than would have been expected if the universe's expansion rate had been constant all along, and therefore we concluded the universe's expansion rate wasn't constant, but was instead increasing over time. And so, here we are.
This is the middle bit.
The universe is a complex place, but we are starting to understand a bit about how it behaves, even though it doesn't really behave, it just does what it does. We humans do have a habit of trying to construct the universe in terms of our own experience. For example,
Dear Cheap Astronomy, is there really such a thing as a dead planet? To begin with, it's probably unreasonably biocentric to define spherical objects that orbit the Sun and have cleared their orbits as either alive or dead. We can redefine the question in terms of planets being geologically active, but there it gets difficult to draw a line between what's active and what isn't. For example, the Moon, which isn't a planet but is widely regarded as geologically inactive, has detectable ground tremors. Some are just asteroid impacts, others are just surface heating and cooling, but there are some that apparently arise from geological activity deep within the Moon's innards. The terminology in this area is a bit fraught. It is largely settled now that geology is a universal term to describe the structural dynamics of rocky celestial objects. There's also a view that earthquakes should be considered a universal term, though it's unclear if that will ever stick. Groundquakes and ground tremors, a cheap astronomy suggestion. There's also an obvious definitional bias towards rocky objects, since no one applies the term geology to the ice and gas giants. Nor are those considered alive or dead, despite ice and gas giants being vastly more dynamic than their rocky counterparts. Of course, the elephant in the room, in any discussion of the relative animation of celestial bodies, is life, and that includes elephants. Surely the best definition of a live planet is one that has life. And since we only have one example of such a live planet, we generally associate any aspects of life with that one example. So on that basis, a living planet is rocky, with a dense atmosphere and liquid water, and even plate tectonics, and some, but not too many, volcanoes. According to our one example, you also need a magnetic field to divert the stellar wind that comes from your local star. On this basis, although Venus is certainly geologically active, it barely spins, and so Venus's magnetic field is negligible, and consequently its dense atmosphere is largely the product of its own geological outgassing, principally CO2, and all the good stuff we're so fond of on Earth, notably nitrogen and water, have been blown away in the solar wind. So, having a molten iron core, and maybe even volcanoes, might seem like geological living, but it's not necessarily a ticket to biological living. Indeed, current thinking is that molten iron cores are more the norm than the exception. Early thinking had it that smaller bodies like the Moon, Mercury, and Mars had cooled to the point where their cores had gone solid, but in fact we are now pretty sure that all of them are similar to Earth in having a solid inner core surrounded by a liquid outer core. So, for a rocky object to have a powerful magnetic field, it not only needs a molten core and spin, but it also needs convection in that molten layer. where hot fluid rises from below, cools, and then sinks back down again, creating a steady circling motion. We now think it's this, plus the planet's spin, that gives you a dynamo effect to create a strong magnetic field. So Earth's magnetic field is a result of the convection and the spin, whereas Venus only has the convection and Mars only has the spin. The reason why Earth and Venus have liquid core convection, while Mars, Mercury and the Moon do not, is probably related to size. All these bodies have enough mass that inward compression due to gravity heats up their cores. The central core is the hottest part, but it's also the most compressed part and so remains solid. It's only the outer core that is able to exist as a molten fluid. With the larger Earth and Venus, the combination of a hotter central core and a greater overall diameter create the right conditions for steady circular convection currents. It's actually apparent from Mars rock samples that Mars did have a strong magnetic field in its early years, but that went away, presumably because Mars's core cooled beyond a point that could continue driving circular convection. But with all this, it's best to say this is just current thinking. Our understanding of how planetary magnetic fields are generated is still a work in progress, and our decision about which planets are alive or dead is just a matter of opinion.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. The universe just is what it is, and it does what it does, but that's never going to stop us from trying to make sense of it on our own terms. Even though progress to date has been the realization that we don't actually know what 96% of the universe actually is. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to make sense of things on your own terms, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and let us construct a reality that works for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.